Wapu hasiayu, guapu diishin, squahahlitsatatsta to all skajit. You already understand what my skajit name is. If I had, you can change one slide there. I don't know where you're at. Are we in the same space? Okay. If I had one purpose of my speaking when I come to speak to people, it is to build bridges so that when you go out and meet Skagit people, I only speak to my family story, but it can be quite similar to other people's stories. We share a lot. So I hope that you have a little more depth and understanding that we lived here, but we're still here. I'm going to go to the houses, two more slides. We lived on the Skagit River, and the Skagit River from the log boom just south of Mount Vernon here, or whatever that direction is there. Clearly my directions aren't working. Clear up to the mountains was 1.5 million acres of land. And we were wealthy, absolutely wealthy. We had every kind of food you could imagine, right? Salmon, deer, elk, berries. We had our own natural medicines. We had deep, deep traditions. So spring and summer were for harvesting and gathering and putting up. You worked really hard so you could prepare for the fall, gather everything and put it up. So in the winter time, it was the season for the spiritual time that would go on for months. So there was a reason for every season, and there was a great deal of value in the system. Elders had their place. For any of you that are parents and you know you have a lot of young kids, most of the time the children spent with their grandparents. One, because grandparents were teaching and loving them and it allowed the parents to do the more physical work. But imagine all the wisdom and value that you see in teaching from the elders, that the elders had an important place. So we weren't stationary, even though we had 11 villages along the river. My great aunt talked about, going from upriver and being gone for weeks with her grandparents. And you'd travel down along the river and visit your family, clear out to get clamshells and, summer stuff. The definition of boundaries was put in there by the government. It wasn't there by us, even though we had villages. They were not like restricted in that way. It was a very fluid. So this picture happens to be a picture of a summer home. So where it might be more stationary, not a longhouse. There was a longhouse of a concrete that was like, that's supposed to be the size of 3 football fields. Imagine that. And families that could live there, right? And live separately. Do the next slide. Back in the late 60s and 70s, this is a group of family and elders. The lady with the glasses on the bottom is my great aunt. The gentleman above her is my brother's grandfather. And they were working tirelessly on how to get recognized. We weren't recognized. We were wards of the federal government, but we weren't recognized. And they would meet up at the concrete 1910 Indian Shaker Church, and they worked tirelessly to get us recognized. I'm gonna have you go to the next one. This is my family. The lady with the baby is my great grandmother and my uncle and my grandfather and their brothers. And you can tell this is after they've been to boarding school one more time. On the other side of the family, this is my great aunt, and this is her joyous, just so you know. So go one more time. A lot of times when I'm talking to people, I want you to meet people, build bridges. It's like, what are the barriers to that? And most often people say, I don't know what to say, or I don't know what to do. I don't want to do the wrong thing, right? What do you call an Indian? Well, in my family, my brother says, my grandpa told me I'm Indian, and that's what I call him. But Native American, Indigenous, First Nations, all of those are probably much better unless you're in a family of Indians. But do you know what the number, yeah. And we still say Indian country. I just went up to a Native American comedy thing, you know, and you know, okay, we can use it even though there's a lot of irony there. But you know what the number one thing Indigenous people like to be called? Any guesses? By their tribe. By their tribe. Yeah, so by their tribe, that identity. So next slide. It wasn't very long ago. People think, well, this was a long time ago. Why are you kind of still talking about this stuff? It wasn't that long. This is, I am still paying the price for my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-grandmother. It wasn't long ago. And if you know anything about historical trauma, family's traumas become literally cellular in your body. So, when I talk to you about this, it's not my intent to make you feel bad or to feel guilty. It's so that when I get to the end of this story and you meet Skagit people or you meet other Native people, maybe you have a fuller picture of what their life is like, or find out in their Native community what their life is like. So I'm going to talk about the lost children first. And the lost children are the children who were taken away after boarding schools when they couldn't do that anymore. I was preparing this presentation. Anybody know Sewell Kanem? Yeah, he's an amazing musician. My brother's best friend, and he said, and I said I served on the Indian Child Welfare Advisory Committee for 10 years. So we supervise all the kids that are out of Native homes. And like anything that the federal government did to Native people, it took a federal law to correct it. The freedom of religion, treaties, Indian child welfare. It took federal laws to get protections that most people had every day. So he said, Kay, why are you not talking about the lost children? And I said, you're right. I mean, I was a foster parent. I know what this story is. So he was adopted out in a non-Native family, which most of our children were up until the Indian Child Welfare Act. And a lot of times the children were lost. They didn't have any idea where their tribe came from. And if they did, they didn't know how to assimilate back into their own tribe because they'd been raised in a non-Native way. And so for him, he one of the gifts that he had was a violin. He's a storyteller and a violinist. But his family would only bring him upstairs if they kind of wanted to show him off, right? So he's in the basement. But they only brought him upstairs if they wanted to show off this great talent, this young man, which left him in a place of isolation and always knowing that he was less than. And that happened to a lot of our children. When you are in a family that's not the same as yours, so like maybe you were raised by a Chinese family and you're Caucasian, right? You're going, my hair doesn't feel like there's my eyes don't look like it, my skin, and it's a place of confusion, especially when you're a young teenager. Next picture, if you get there, I have a picture of Sewell Kanem. He is an amazingly gifted man. He went into the army, became a drill sergeant and a pastor's assistant or a chaplain's assistant. I said, well, how did those work together? He said, I just marched him over to the chaplain. And it has taken him a long time to find his space back in his traditional teachings and community. It's a long journey home. And he works every day to help people understand what that journey home is. With taking care of babies, you can see you even got a handbook on how to take care of Indian babies. I nothing more said about that one. Next slide. This is the heart of what I share. And kind of cool. It's a walking stick that my brother painted for me. But not very many people can actually touch this. When the government came to take our children, they didn't know how old they were. So they had a measuring stick. And if you were higher than this, they could take you. So I'm going to tell you kind of a story that wraps up what that might look like. because you're all in a gathering space here, imagine that all your children and your grandchildren and your nieces and nephews, all the babies of your community are out there playing. You know how when you're in a meeting, you can hear the kids laughing and one chasing each other, little giggles and the oops and all that stuff, but you can still hear them. And this person comes up to speak to you. It's clearly their government. They're very important. And they tell you, we are going to take care of your children. We are going to make sure that they're educated, that they dress right, they eat right, they pray right. We are going to make your children better. We're going to make them better. And you don't have a choice whether you want them to be made better. And you go outside and it's silent because all the children are gone. As a grandfather, a grandmother, a father, an auntie, an older brother, how helpless do you feel? You can do nothing. But they tell you, you can write the children twice a year on their birthday and Christmas, and they are hundreds of miles away from you. And when they're away, they will not speak your language. They will not eat your traditional foods, and certainly they will not practice your traditional religion because they will be punished. If they try to run away, they'll be caught and sent back. If they get pneumonia or tuberculosis there, you know, the older kids will take care of them. They're often hungry and they're lonely. And they lose their sense of self. So for the last, I don't know how many years, when I was young, every time I introduced myself to an elder, I wanted to know, did you go to boarding school? And that's at Tulalip, by the way. And they would tell me their story, right? I always knew my mother and my grandparents went to boarding school, but I found out this year through Tulalip that my great-grandparents went as well. So imagine the effects of parenting and family when you have three generations in institution. It changes the very core. My grandfather died at 50 years old of sclerosis of the liver, and I'm pretty sure he did a slow suicide because he had no place in society at all. Next one. So last week I met a lady at the Anacortes Democrat meeting that I was at, and she grew up in Anacortes, and one of the stories she told me had a profound effect on me. Chamau was in Salem, Oregon. Most of several generations started in Tulalip. That's the picture you saw. So she was a stewardess in Alaska Airlines. One day she said the plane was filled with little Alaskan children. And they were crying, some were vomiting, some were just stunned. And they couldn't figure out why all these native children were on this plane. I mean, they didn't know why they were there. And then they flew them to Oregon. I said, oh, you flew them to Chamawa. So Chamawa had children from Montana, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, Alaska. Those children had no idea where they were going. They had no idea. I don't know what it's like, the idea that you are powerless to protect your children when most parents would lay down their lives for their children. This is my mother on the far right, Imogene, her grandparents, my great-grandfather. So they have all experienced boarding school. My mother, her answer, she didn't get to go to college. And if I'm too long, just tell me to shut up, okay? So back in her 40s, having lost that opportunity, she's wickedly smart, she went back to school and got a degree in political science and became an incredible activist. And it wasn't for one person. It was for farm workers and LGBTQ and anybody. She knew what it was like to stand with somebody to have a voice. So once, I always said my mom fell on her knees a lot, but she got up strong. So this is my mom graduating from Chamawa. She is salutatorian. That does not look like happy kids, does it? These are the best of the best. And I envision that little girl and how lonely she felt. One year, my mom didn't get to come home from Chimawa. She had to stay there. And they were often hungry. You couldn't just, like, go to the kitchen and get an apple. And I would stay with my mom. She was dying, and I was living with her, and we're having a great time being together. And I brought her a peach pie, and out came this story. One time when she was a little girl, she was at Chimawa over the summer, and there was a peach farm next door. And her little friend in their little skirts went and gathered peaches. They were so excited. They were going to get peaches. And then the farmer caught him, and he starts chasing him and yelling. You can imagine the peaches flying out. And my mom, I could see this little girl, goes, they would have been so good. So I have one good story to tell you. This is Annabelle, and Annabelle's still with us. She's the youngest member of her family, the only living member. And I said, Annabelle, did you go to boarding school? And she said, no, I did not. As the youngest one, her older siblings, when the government man, and that's what they called him, the government man came to take her, the older siblings stood in front of her and said, you will not take this one. There's about 10 kids. You will not take this one. Well, I cried for days. Then I found the rest of the story. While her siblings were standing in front of her, her dad, who was a Indian Shaker pastor, a millsman, really respected member of the upper community, was begging this government man, can I please just raise one of my children? He was pleading and begging with the government man, can I just raise one child? And the humbleness of this really good man begging to raise this child. But she did not go to boarding school. Next, this is my brother's grandfather. He went to Chimawa. These are pictures. This is how I found out that my great-grandmother went, because Tulalip started showing pictures of people who had been there.
That's how I found that out.
So this is the best part I want to leave you with. Native people are super resilient. We have to be to even be here today. And the way that we do that is recognize the pain that we've been through. Some of our people don't even know what that is. They don't even know where the pain is coming from. They don't know how far back it goes. So that's the work that we have to do, is help understand. I know it helped me to understand my mom, and then her mom who was murdered, and then her mom, right? It helped me understand and have grace for things that might have been difficult. So, you know, the price that we have paid, and it's much worse now, is alcoholism, drug addiction. If I were to give a pebble today, I raised three foster children. They have not been in much in my life for over 25 years because of alcohol and drug addiction. And I went to two of their family funerals last week. We had like seven in 2 weeks. One was an uncle and one was a cousin, and they allowed me to just love and protect and mom them, which was the greatest gift I could ever have. One of them is alcoholic and the other one's drug addicted, and she said, Mom, I've saved six or seven of my friends myself with Narcan. And that day she agreed to go start her drug treatment again because she'd had a successful period. And my son is considering going to alcohol treatment, because the pain is so deep, you want to go into a dark space that nothing can hurt. And so I am truly grateful that, you know, we're on like day four. I'll take that. So drug addiction, and it's deadly. I think three or four of the deaths in this past 2 weeks were fentanyl related. And we have a really high suicide rate. And I think my grandfather committed suicide by drinking. I think you can do both of those things. Domestic violence and suicide. So it there's a price to be paid when you can't touch the pain, right? So the most important thing is Native people are resilient, and really we need to help each other figure out how we heal from this. We're strong and we're deeply spiritual. There is no separation of church and state. It is a space in our life. It is not a structure or an organization. It goes with us all the time. This is the most important part, is how we heal. I told you I was up at a Native American comedy. Indian people love to laugh. So So it's just like, we love to tease you too. We really like you. You know you're being really liked if we tease you. Family's really important. Our elders are really important. I did a celebration at the Lutheran Church, and I thought I was supposed to be the person doing this. And I said, well, I'm going to center this around elders, right? And I thought, this is pretty cool. I got them all gifts. And then I found out they're like, I don't want to be an elder because, because I think they associate it with feeble and unappreciated. I'm like, so I had to convince them over this period of time that this was an honor and to rephrase what elder meant, right? Along with mental health programs where the mental health providers are really understand Native culture and trauma and healing, that's really important. We have really specialized counselors. We have drug and alcohol programs like Dugualich, which is Swinomish. It's really important that they understand, you understand me, right? It's amazing. They really are doing a good job. And the most important one to me, if I could have it all by itself, is that I believe the only way that we can heal is if we recover what was taken from our family. Stories, language, our songs, our teachings. And every time, I'm not a fluent speaker, but my mom couldn't speak at all, and her older brother did. Every time I speak our language, I offer that up to my family as a sign of healing. I'm trying to learn stories now to start storytelling. Many people they're doing their drumming, they're doing the canoeing, and each piece of that, I believe, is healing for us and healing for our ancestors. So that truly is the most important part. And this is Vi Hilbert, the lady who I said her blessing. She almost single-handedly saved our language. She worked with a linguist and made a dictionary. She recorded stories from all the elders in the Northwest. And what I love most about, she spoke everywhere. She said, everywhere I go, people think I should just have pearls of wisdom drop from my mouth. And it was both funny and true, right? I think this is about the end. These are some of the ways that we're doing our culture. Canoe Journey, anybody been to Canoe Journey? Absolutely amazing. And a lot of times people don't understand when you go to Canoe Journey, when they host you, you just go in and they feed you. And somebody says, well, where do you pay at? You don't pay, you just get to eat. And the children, when they're learning dances and they're learning traditions, those children will stand up and they'll be proud of who they are. Not the generations that taught us in B movies that Indians were savages and drunks and all those kinds of things. They get a different message, the message of really who they are. This is, any of you know Jay, my brother Jay. This was one of his first paintings that he did down in Tulalip at one of the canoe journeys. And he envisioned this before all the houses and everything. This is, when I go out in the valley, this is what I see. I see before that, right? And so, for me, the most important thing is that you feel comfortable enough to ask questions, that you learn more about tribal communities, and that you take the risk to step out into the community. I know most of the people I know that build relationships in tribal community are richer for it, and building relationships with people of any differences, I believe, we're richer for.